Today's Tensho will be on case 52 in the Heikigan Roku, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 52 is entitled Joshu's Stone Bridge. Main subject, a monk said to Joshu, "The stone bridge of Joshu is widely renowned, but coming here I find only a set of stepping stones." Joshu said, "You see only the stepping stones and do not see the stone bridge." The monk said, "What stone bridge?" Joshu said, "It lets donkeys cross over and horses cross over." Secho's verse, "No show of transcendence, his path was high. If you've entered the great sea of Zen, you should catch a giant turtle." I can't help laughing at old Kankei, his contemporary, who said, "It is quick as an arrow, a mere waste of labor." Thank you very much for coming to practice Zen today. Some of you are here for the first time. You have never had the chance to come to one of the Saturday sits, and I'm very glad you could make it. This is a wonderful opportunity to deepen your practice. We are now involved in what is called a Tensho. A Tensho, many people in the West think of as a kind of lecture on Buddhism, on Zen practice. But actually, that's not quite right. In modern Zen communities, you will actually find teachers who have notes or even typed up scripts. But you're really not supposed to have any kind of a script at all. Basically, you're supposed to sit deeply with the koan, and then when it's time to deliver the Tensho, you're supposed to just go with it and see where it goes. So it's a lot like Zen practice itself. You know, you really have to trust in the process and trust in your big mind. It's not always successful, I have to admit, you know. Some Tenshos don't come together. Some of them are pretty disorienting and maybe not very satisfying in certain ways. But the practice of Zen is not about getting things right, so-called. It's about trusting your true nature, Tensho doesn't actually mean lecture. A Tensho is actually an offering. See, it's an offering. So, you know, basically it's like putting flowers on the altar. I'm going to reach into myself and try to pull out something that I can give to other people, right? And it's really not my place to judge the value of what I can do. It's really my place to just try. And one person might say after a Tensho, might not tell me, but might leave here thinking, "Oh, that really stank today. That wasn't very good." Somebody else might think, "Oh, that was deeply moving, you know?" So you just don't know. It's really not in my control. All I can do is sit on the cushion, empty myself out, and see what arises when I trust the process, trust my true nature. So if you're listening to a Tensho also, and this is your first time, you know, please don't approach it as an academic lecture. There's not going to be a quiz later on. And you really don't have to focus on every word that I say. Ideally, you should be meditating. So, you know, you're still watching your breath, your back is straight, and you're listening to the talk sort of out of one ear, and you're focusing your attention on the breath also as you're listening. So this is a kind of meditation practice in itself, just like sutra recitation. Often at sesshins, people have the best. Sesshins are our meditation retreats. Often at sesshins, people have the best sit of the whole day right after the Tensho. So, you know, after we have a Taisho, there's a sit after that at our retreats, and people often tell me that that was the best sit of the day. So this is a little actually more challenging than just sitting and watching your breath. You have to watch the breath, continue to meditate, but also listen sort of out of the corner of your mind to my voice. And it's really not so important to understand the content of what's being said. It's really not that important. A lot of it is just being present to hear, just the practice of hearing, practice of listening. And sometimes things resonate in a Taisho in a way that they wouldn't in a lecture. You know, when we listen to a lecture, sometimes we're engaged, and sometimes we're not. Sometimes we're bored. And sometimes we're waiting to be entertained. You know, we're waiting for, you know, if you watch TED Talks sometimes, you know, those people are very skillful manipulators of the audience. You know, so they give a talk over and over again and refine their strategies. And they know how to get a laugh. They know how to, you know, skillfully manipulate the responses of their audiences, and they're very highly polished and highly rehearsed. And TED Talks can be interesting, right? But there's a kind of naturalness that's missing, right? You don't see the process that created this. It's all hidden behind the scenes. You know, so if we all like a TED Talk kind of talk, we're going to be disappointed with most talks we hear. And we're not going to really have a lot of respect for the process of thinking things through and being open to the possibilities of the unexpected, right? So a Taisho is a different kind of process. It's like watching somebody work, right? You know, if you see the finished product, that's great. But when you watch somebody work, you see the mistakes, you see them go this way and run into a blind alley, or go this way and run into a wall, and sort of work their way back out and go forward. You know, this is the real process of living, right? You know, we go in this direction and we get blocked. We try something else and we get blocked. You know, and then we try something else, and unexpectedly it opens up in a new direction. If we're prepared, if we're open, we'll follow the new direction and see where it goes. You know, so this idea of like a spontaneous talk is not maybe as satisfying in some ways. It's like a very finished, polished presentation. But on the other hand, there's a kind of openness to it. You know, so I would say just listen along. You know, I've sat with a number of Zen teachers. You know, and Genki Roshi, my first teacher, his Taishos were extremely disorganized, and at the end you'd just be left, scratching your head. Really, it would just be like, what the hell, you know? Halfway through, I would just think, where is this going? I have no idea. But you know, it's almost 40 years later, and I can still remember some of his talks. I'll be meditating in the morning, and something he said that I didn't hear at the time comes back to me, you know. And so, you know, this is listening with your, you could say, your inner ear, or listening with your, in Zen we have a word, we use this word heart-mind. In Chinese there's a word xin, which can mean heart or it can mean mind. Heart or mind, xin. In the West we say heart and we say mind. They're separated. And normally they are separated. You know, our mental lives are very different from our heart lives, from our emotional lives. And this creates a kind of dryness kind of dryness to our lives, right? Just ideas can be very dry. So, this is sort of a culture, product of our culture, this idea of like pure thinking with no heart. But in Asian culture, they didn't value that so highly. This idea of sheen, heart-mind, is how we should approach things. It's with the sheen. In Japanese, this is called kokoro. In Sanskrit too, like we recite the Heart Sutra, heart, hridya, is also meaning mind and heart. So this unity of mind and heart is, you know, you can live from that place. You can do many things in that place. And one of them is listen, and one of them is speak, you know. So the purpose of a teisho is not to impart information. It's to trust in a process, whether you're on the giving end or you're on the receiving end. And the process is uncontrollable. It's uncontrollable. Nobody knows where this is going to wind up, you know. And if you are a person of Zen, if you practice Zen, you realize that this is a beautiful way to live life. You know, it's a trusting life by being in your shin, in your heart, your kokoro, right? So please forgive me if I say things that are contradictory, or if I get lost, or if I have said these things before, you know. This is just a process of making the offering for the day. So, you know, in Zen, we put a lot of emphasis on what are called koans. So this little story I just read is a conversation between a very famous Tang Dynasty Zen master named, in Japanese he's called Joshu. In Mandarin, his name is something like Zhao Zhou. He was a great, probably one of the greatest Zen masters of the Tang Dynasty. And this story is about his conversation with somebody. So a monk said to Zhao Zhou, "The stone bridge of Zhao Zhou is widely renowned, but coming here, I see only a set of stepping stones." So, you know, one way to understand this is that the monk is living in a mind with no heart. See, so he's got a very sharp intellect, very sharp critical intellect, but we could say inadequately developed hridya, shin, kokoro. And Joshu is a very good teacher, so he's trying to help him. He's not offended. This is kind of like an insult, right? The monk says, "Oh, you're the great Joshu. I've heard a lot about Joshu's stone bridge, but all I see are a bunch of stepping stones. Some bridge. You call yourself a great Zen master?" See, that's sort of the implication of this. So it's a somewhat impolite, right? So you're the great Joshu. I don't see a big bridge. I just see some little stepping stones. Joshu says, "You see only the stepping stones and did not see the bridge." The monk said, "What stone bridge?" Joshu says, "It lets donkeys cross over and horses cross over." Now, you know, when you heard that story the first time, it was probably confusing. When you hear it the second time, it's actually more confusing. So, you know, these koans in Zen are not supposed to be processed with your discriminating mind. You know, in order to work with a koan, you have to be able to enter a state called samadhi. So, you know, we sit on the cushion, we watch the breath, and sometimes you feel like you're in the groove. You feel like you're in this deep place. In classical Buddhist thinking, this is called, when you have reach this place, you are called a stream enterer, a shrota apana, a stream enterer. That is a person who has entered the stream. And that stream is what you enter when you're in deep samadhi. So it's not always possible for beginners to get into deep samadhi. You know, sometimes you sit down on the cushion and it's just hard, right? You've got a lot of thoughts popping up in your mind. You have maybe physical discomfort, and sometimes your mental agitation can produce physical discomfort, even pain. So if your mind is not calm and balanced, your body is probably tense. And when you sit for long periods of time, it probably produces physical pain. One way we respond to physical pain, by the way, is thinking. Thinking is churning out thoughts. So it's like a little wheel that turns. You know, the body's uncomfortable and the mind becomes agitated, which makes the body uncomfortable, which makes the mind agitated. So in Zen practice, we immobilize the body, we put it on a cushion, we straighten the spine, we breathe from the Manipura chakra, the Dantian. We squeeze the breath out and we follow the breath. And, you know, you may have a lot of thoughts to work through. You may be restless physically, but at the end of a certain amount of meditation, you're going to be much calmer, much more stable. And eventually you may feel like you're immersed in something. Or immersed in something. It's like just like entering a stream, right? Or diving into a river. You're in this flow. This flow, this is called samadhi, samadhi. And if you've experienced samadhi, you are a stream enterer, a shrota apana. Basically, when you're in samadhi, your mind is no longer operating in the usual way. You know, ordinarily, our minds are consumed by the thinking process, right? You know, so ordinarily our attention is consumed by thinking. And, you know, you may, when you're really thinking, you may not even be aware of your body at all. It's a very artificial state that modern life taught us to cultivate at the expense of a much healthier way of life. So when we do meditation, we're not going to be in that particular kind of consciousness. We're going to be in this other consciousness, which is the unified body-mind experiencing the world. That it feels so beautiful, samadhi, stream entering, because now we've restored the proper balance between body and mind. We're no longer in that nervous, disembodied intellect. The mind, the Western mind, we're now in the heart mind. See, sheen. And when you, if your teacher gives you a koan, traditionally in Zen, the teacher will give you a koan to work on. You internalize the koan. So in this case, all you would have to do is hear the story once or twice, and then when you sit down on the cushion and meditate, instead of counting the breath, on each out breath you would say bridge, 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 bridge. And you know, you would say bridge the way people say a mantra, like a mantra. Now, you know, people misunderstand meditation, especially in the modern world, you know. When people think about meditation in the modern world, they think of it as imparting calm, and maybe bliss, right? And if you meditate, it will bring you calm and bliss. But that's not all there is to meditation. If you go to the bookstore, you go to Barnes & Noble, there are many, many books on meditation, as a matter of fact. There's like 100 of them. And many of them are called books on mindfulness, meditation. And it's hugely popular. It's just like this is a big industry. You know, and people want to do meditation because it promises them, calmness. And they think maybe it will make them more efficient. You know, get them through the day, be more efficient. If you're stressed out, you can sit down on the cushion and watch your breath, and you'll become calmer. You may even have a little bit of happiness, bliss. You know, that just sounds wonderful. But that is not a 100% good thing. You know, if you're in emotional distress, if you're in a lot of emotional distress, if something's gone wrong in your life and you're on fire with agitation or fear or a sense of loss, you know, being able to sit down on the cushion and calm your mind and get to this samadhi state, this calm, stable state, is really like a lifesaver. It's wonderful. But you know, if you can use meditation to get to that state, it doesn't really get to the heart. It's like treating the symptom, but not treating the disease. See? So many people think of meditation as a strategy or a technique that will help them deal with their stress, help them deal with their anxiety, and get them to a calm place. And it will. You know, in some traditions of meditation, people think that samadhi is the highest state. You know, for example, in some schools of Hinduism, people think that when you reach samadhi, you're now communing with God, and that's it. You're there. Buddhism has a very different view of samadhi. You know, the Buddhist view of samadhi is you're in a blissful place, in a calm place, but it's not enlightenment, and you still have all of you're still in possession of all the personality traits and mental habits that are causing you to feel fearful or stressful or alone or angry in the first place. See? So when people use meditation just to get to a calm, blissful state, this is a mixed blessing, right? Because they may not go deeper and explore the sources of their suffering and remove the sources of their suffering. See? So it worries me a little bit. I'm thrilled that all these people are doing meditation. I'm thrilled. But I do think that at some point they're in for an unpleasant surprise, right? I do occasionally read stories from people who say, I meditated for 20 years and I fell into deep depression. And you think, how can that happen? It's very easy, very easy. Because, you know, when they meditate, they're just getting to this blissful place, happy place, calm place, and they're not dealing with their stuff, right? They're treating the symptoms for 20 years, but not the disease, right? So my feeling is that meditation is a little bit abused when we use it just this way, when we're searching for bliss or we're searching for calm. I love samadhi. I get into samadhi all the time. I'm so happy for samadhi. And unless you can get into samadhi, that calm, blissful state, you can't accomplish anything in terms of the deeper levels of meditation. So it's absolutely necessary to be able to get into samadhi, and very, very deep samadhi. Deep samadhi. How deep? Very deep. You know, in the Mumonkan, at one point, Mumon says, if you're really in deep samadhi, if somebody hits you with a 2x4, you won't even feel it. See, that's how deep. And you might think that's science fiction. And it probably is. But you can get pretty close. I mean, you know, you can get very, very close. I will never forget, I had been practicing Zen for about 6 years, and I was at a sesshin at our temple outside of Seattle. And at that time, there were no windows in the temple. We hadn't finished building the building. So it was summer, it didn't really matter, but, you know, insects would fly in and out. And Genki Roshi was giving a talk, a teisho. And a bee, or like a hornet or a bumblebee or something, not a bumblebee, a hornet or like a yellow jacket or something, flew into the zendo while he was talking and landed on my hand. Now, you know, Genki Roshi was a Japanese Buddhist priest, and he ran the temple just like a Japanese temple. So we did not move a muscle. It was absolutely the case that you would not move a muscle. So he's giving his talk, and this bee lands on my hand. And I could just see him ready to sting me, right? Now look, you can't swat the bee. You can't. If you're a Buddhist, you can't swat the bee, okay? Don't do it. You know, that's against the law, right? So you could brush him off, but you're not supposed to move. So I just sat there and I watched the bee sting my hand. And I thought, the whole time I thought, this is really going to hurt. But this was like day three of a session, and I just closed my eyes and I watched my breath and I went into deep samadhi. It was like nothing, like nothing. You know, I was able to simply drop into a place where that pain really was no longer a problem. And this is true for the pain in your legs too. You'll get to a place where that's just not a problem. Very deep samadhi. Imperturbable. There's a place inside you that's absolutely still and imperturbable, like the eye of a hurricane. I swear to you, it's there. And when you get there, it's amazing, amazing. So you know, getting into deep samadhi is very important. Even physical pain can disappear. You know, but it's not enlightenment. It's not enlightenment. So, you know, at some, you know, people can get addicted to samadhi, believe it or not. It's you have to be able to get into samadhi, but people can get addicted to samadhi. They love that blissful, buzzy feeling, right? And you can get addicted to yoga, too, right? You get into this blissful, buzzy feeling after yoga. But that blissful, buzzy feeling is not enlightenment, the Buddha says. It's just a preliminary stage. So, you know, when you get into samadhi, you know, you're still clinging to all kinds of things. You still have a lot of unresolved issues, right? So in our tradition, Zen, we work on koans. And koans are about getting into our deeper mind, our unconscious or subconscious mental habits, and getting at those obstacles, right? You're treating the disease, not the symptoms, right? Treating the disease, not the symptoms. You know, so we all have disease. We do. We all have our diseases, I guess I should say. You know, and we aren't aware of them. Generally speaking, we aren't aware of them. You know, if you live long enough, you will meet many people who are profoundly self-destructive people. You know, so, you know, I have, you know, I have. There was a person in Rutgers who, you know, can be this incredibly charming and intelligent, funny guy. And when he came to Rutgers, he was hired to be an administrator at Rutgers. And I was on the committee that interviewed this guy and hired this guy. And, you know, he was such a charmer, right? He was just like charming. And he was funny. You know, at times we'd all be like, he was like a comedian, right? So he had it all. He was, you know, basically smart. He had an advanced degree, I can't remember, some science. He was funny and charming. He was handsome. You know, all the women on the committee were flirting with him the whole time. And some of the men. And he was, I myself think I was flirting with him. Yeah. I was just charmed with this guy. And I wanted him to like me. So, you know, basically, he was offered a job, and he at first was doing this wonderful, wonderful job. But, you know, then things began to happen, right? So I remember somebody coming to see me and saying, basically, he yelled, you know, he had this friend of mine, this woman I know very well, came to talk to me and said, I've just met with so-and-so, and I'm really shaken. I said, what? What happened, you know? He actually yelled at me. What? How could he yelled at you? For what? You know, and it was like for nothing. You know, it turns out that this guy had like a lot of anger under the surface, you know, under the surface. And he was he could be very vindictive. And it turns out, you know, he had like this, we say, hair trigger. You know, it would be a lovely. He'd be lovely, charming, and then if you did something that that crossed a line in him, right? He would just lash out. And over the years, you know, I saw this again and again. And you know, basically, he himself was really unaware of this. Honestly, you know, if you asked, you know, if you had asked, I didn't ask him this, but you know, if you asked him to characterize himself, I'm sure he would say, "I'm a wonderful guy. I'm a kind, generous person." You know, but he has this hair trigger. Another person I know actually said that he had done something, and this administrator. My friend told me, actually, he said, when I was done talking to him, I was actually shaking. So you know, if you go to see the guy, funny, charming, and I don't think he's phony. I don't think he's pretending to be funny and charming. I think he has unresolved problems that he hasn't dealt with. And I think he has all of these fears and anxieties he hasn't seen in himself. You know, so we all have things like that. Maybe they don't make other people suffer. Maybe they make us suffer, you know. So I don't know if you had the delightful opportunity to see. Do you know who Rand Paul is? Somebody I must say I'm never going to vote for, even if I'm being tortured, you know. But he was interviewed by a woman on. The television show a few days ago, on a television show, news show. And she asked him a question that was a little bit of a challenge, right? And he actually started shushing her. He went shh, 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 shh. And he cut her off and started shushing her, right? And then, next day, he was interviewed on the Today Show. I know this because I read Salon, and they had the clips on Salon. And another woman interviewed him, and he cut her off and interrupted her as she was asking her question, and she kept going with her question. She didn't want to be intimidated by him, so he started talking over her question. And then he said, "Stop interrupting me." Right. Okay. Third time. It turns out yesterday he was interviewed by a reporter from The Guardian. This time not a woman. And the guy asked him a tough question, and Rand Paul got up and stormed out. Right? Just stormed out of the interview. Well, I hope you understand he's not going to be president. He's not even going to run for president, really. This is somebody who has, he has unresolved problems, right? He has unresolved problems. And it's destroying his political career, right? So we all have things like that. And you know, if you ask Rand Paul, what kind of person are you? Somebody actually asked him. They said, "Do you have a problem with women?" He said, "Well, I love women. What are you talking about?" You know, but when he was interviewed by these women, he shut them up. He told them to shut up by shh, 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 shh. He interrupted them and claimed they were interrupting him, and so on and so on. So he clearly does have problems that he's totally unaware. So, you know, we all have things like that. And if we just practice Zen to enter samadhi and be in this blissful, calm state, we really aren't going to liberate ourselves. See, we aren't going to liberate. We're not going to be liberated. So you know, the hard work of meditation is dealing with our stuff. But that is how you become enlightened. That is what enlightenment is. You know, another way to put it is, all the barriers in life are in you. In you. You know, all the barriers are in you. They're not in the world, they're in you. And unless you take down those barriers, you can't be fully present with the world. You know, I've talked about this before. I suppose the biggest barrier in life is dying, right? You know, that's our fear of dying is the biggest barrier, right? You know, I have had some family members die in the last maybe decade, right? When my father got cancer, everybody in my family dies of cancer. When my father got cancer, he got very depressed. Dying was very hard for him. He was only 69. And he felt terribly cheated. You know, he had just retired, and he had these dreams of all this wonderful freedom, and now he was dying of cancer. And really depressed and unhappy, you know. And I've had other people in my family who also died of cancer, who sort of faced it the same way, right? You know, and I certainly wouldn't criticize, you know. I mean, it was a terrible thing to die, you know, so young. But, you know, years ago, I was, when I was at the Seattle Zen Center, a friend of Genki Roshi's came to stay with him, and he was dying of cancer also. And this was many years before my father died, but this guy was so radiant and luminous, right? He was so happy, you know, and he would have to go to sleep a lot. He would just get exhausted, and he wasn't always at his best. He didn't always have a smile on his face. But there was this life in his eyes and this incredible energy that left this deep impression on me. You know, I don't think death was the barrier for him that it was for my father. You know, I think he had been doing Zen for 50 years, and it was like, this is the next great adventure, is to embrace this. You know, I'm going to die. I'm going to be fully present with the whole process. I'm going to trust in the process of dying, right? I'm 100% sure that's how he felt about it. I'm going to trust in trusted in the process of living. I'm going to trust in the process of dying. And he had real joy because that was no longer a barrier in him, no longer a barrier, you know? And so Zen is really about breaking down these, you know, one of the reasons I became an English professor instead of a writer was that I really couldn't tolerate insecurity, right? Like a financial insecurity, I have to confess. You know, so I have friends who are like writers and artists, and you know, they go through periods where there's no checks coming in, right? And they have all these projects. So my wife's uncle, Paul Suttman, was a sculptor, and he was very successful, but you know, there'd be these long periods where there's just no income, right? And he's making statues, he's sending things off to Italy, to the foundry in Italy, and they would come back and he'd be finishing. And then, you know, there'd be a show and he would recoup what he spent on all the materials, and he could live for, you know, 5 years very comfortably on that, you know. But that terrifies me, I have to say. It's a barrier myself, right? I like to get that check every 2 weeks. I know it's coming, right? When I get it, I don't get it in my hands anymore, but I like imagining it in my hands. So, you know, for Paul, this was not a problem. You know, Paul actually never had I don't think he ever had a job in his life where he got a check every 2 weeks, you know. He loved the freedom of being an artist, and my brother-in-law is like that too, Jonathan, my wife's brother. You know, he's an artist, and you know, he has this great freedom, but somehow the insecurity doesn't bother him, right? So you know, we all have these obstacles in ourselves. You know, for some people, losing a job is like a death, right? And for some people, it's like being let out of jail. The difference is in themselves. It's the barriers are in yourself. See? Zen practice is about encountering our barriers and working them through on the cushion. So, you know, sometimes people, you know, at the end of a sitting period, I will go around to people and I will say, how was your sit? And people will say, wonderful. Every once in a while, somebody will say, can I talk to you after the sit? You know, and you know, they might talk to me privately and say, you know, I have this incredible anger that just came up on the cushion. Is Zen making me angry? And of course, it's not Zen making them angry. That's in there. You know, whatever is in there is going to come out. And that's, you know, probably if you continue to practice Zen and you encounter that anger, one of the questions you're going to have to explore is, where is that coming from? You know, where's that coming from? Sometimes a koan can bring this out, right? So, you know, you'll be working with a koan, and sometimes all of a sudden you'll have this feeling like maybe the koan, you'll be working with a koan, and all of a sudden you will feel anger. Or maybe all of a sudden you'll realize that you feel tremendous jealousy towards your brother, or something like that. Something you didn't see in yourself, ever, right? And, you know, whatever comes out is going to come out, and then, you know, it's a barrier in yourself you have to work through. And the way we work through our barriers is with mushin, emptiness. So, you know, if you can get into deep samadhi, the next stage in Zen practice is emptiness meditation. Your mind becomes absolutely blank and empty. And most people think blank, you know, emptiness sounds terrible. But you know, emptiness is a possibility, right? When your mind is blank, you can experience the world in a new and different way, right? Without your old baggage getting in the way. So one way to think about emptiness in Buddhism is that it's possibility, it's openness. It's a chance to start your life again in a different way. See? So, you know, when you're sitting on the cushion and you're in anger or in fear or anxiety, you know, if you keep watching the breath, eventually the sources of that are probably going to become clear to you. You'll remember things about your life or you'll have insight. But that doesn't set you free. You have to reach a point where you let it go. So we keep going back to this blankness, back to this blankness, and eventually, you know, you're calm and serene, your mind is open, and you're alive. You feel alive, right? Energy. And this is called working through. You know, so the barrier has now ceased to be a barrier, right? You know, the koan collection in that we work with, one of the koan collections, is called Mu Mon Kan, U Men Kwan, the Gate of No Barrier. Sounds like a contradiction, Gate of No Barrier, but see, these barriers in ourselves are all illusory, right? Even meditation has barriers, right? So, you know, the first time you meditate, you came here to meditate or somewhere, you know, as somebody might have said, we meditate for half an hour. Right? And you might have thought to yourself, half an hour? No way! I can't do that. So, you know, but you come here and you realize, you know, halfway through you're not going to run screaming out of the room, probably. You know, you can do it. You watch the breath, and half an hour goes like that. And that's a barrier in yourself that you've just dissolved, right? And people hear about sesshin, and somebody says, oh, you know, we meditate for 9 hours a day. Oh, there's no way. I could never do that. You know, at the end of sesshin, it's going to be like this, like a blink of an eye. And, you know, if you work through your pain, you work through your obstacles, you feel this wonderful sense of, it's like connection with life. You know, as we become human beings, as we become adults, we create these barriers. I could never do that. I would never do that, etc., etc. But you know, we crash through those barriers in Zen, and then it's like letting the light in, you know? It's like letting the light, letting the energy flow freely through your body instead of holding it back. A monk said to Joshu, the stone bridge of Joshu is widely renowned, but coming here I see only a set of stepping stones. Joshu said, you see only the stepping stones and you do not see the stone bridge. The monk said, "What stone bridge?" Joshu said, "It lets donkeys cross over and horses cross over." You know, Zen is all about crossing over. You could say bridge, you could say crossing over. We all have these barriers we don't think we can cross, right? All these barriers. You know, Zen is not about sitting in serenity and calmness. That's a huge mistake. And if you're meditating for that goal, you're not really helping yourself. You know, Zen is about working through our barriers and encountering life more deeply. You know, every time we crash through a barrier in ourselves, the world becomes a bigger place. You know, I have met people who are pretty much fearless. You know, in my Zen career, I've run into Zen teachers who are pretty much fearless people. You know, like that guy who was at Genki Roshi's place, you know. You know, if you're not afraid of death, you're not afraid of anything, really. You know, if you're not afraid of loneliness, what do you have to fear? You know, if you're not afraid of being abandoned, everybody is your friend, right? So these barriers are well worth working through, and you came here today and you did some of that. And I hope you continue.